Senator Eliason is excused from the call, and Senator Jill Sassini is in finance, so has to be excused. The first order of business will be Senate Bill 127. An act relating to the power and jurisdiction of courts in cases involving minors. We have a committee substitute. It's my understanding that the House has a similar bill that they're working on. In fact, I believe that they were having a floor action on today. I do not know what the title of the bill is. I wonder if one of the staff could find out what the title of that bill is right away.
It's HB 109.
And what's the title?
I think it has the same title. The title. Maybe Mr.
If I may, that bill, the final version, I have a preliminary draft that says an act relating to persons 16 or 17 years of age who are charged with unclassified or class A felonies and amending the children's waiver provisions. Now, it's possible that the title was changed. It did pass this morning, sir, but I don't have a copy of the final version.
But my problem is that if it has a comparable title, and we could, as it has passed their group, we could wait till it arrives here and work on that bill rather than this bill. But if, with the new rules, which you cannot change the title in the opposite house, and if it didn't take care of some of the things we're interested in, didn't come under it, then you have to pass your own bill.
Chairman, I think it would have a different title because we do have some extra things.
I wonder if you'd be so kind as not to guess at it and go find out. Could you do that?
Okay.
I can go look in the book and find out. Okay. Go in the Senate Secretary's office, John, and get the closest place and look and see exactly what the title is.
Will do.
Thank you very much. Is there something that we understand that you have a real pressing problem, Gail, and that you are wanted in some other committee? So, if there's something that you want to say, you identify yourself, and if there's something you want to say in the midterm, we'll find out. We'll be more than happy to get your information.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate the indulgence. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky, and I'm from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Just to let the committee know, what this particular CS is, it's the waiver bill that Mr. Price and I testified about at the earlier hearing. I think it was about a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago. Interspaced with the provisions from your original bill, Senator Ray, which dealt with waiver and also releasing information about minors and raising the value for which you can obtain restitution if the minor maliciously destroyed property. So your bill, in addition, the original version, in addition to addressing the waiver, also addressed other things in Title 47. This proposed committee substitute retains those original versions of your bill and substitutes the version we had discussed earlier for all of the waiver provisions.
I believe with the title of the bill, an act relating to criminal prosecution of minors, that would, do you see anything in the committee substitute that would be contrary to that title?
Well, you do have some material in here which, the title is an act relating to criminal prosecution of minors?
Right.
No, I don't think there's anything in here that would be outside that.
Right.
This is a more expanded version, but it's all related to that.
Well, there is some section, I'm sorry, Chairman, there is some section in the proposed committee substitute that deal with the emancipated minors.
They deal with their liability for malicious destruction of property.
So that would be within that.
It deals with criminal offenses. It's not strictly prosecution. It deals with restitution. But
no, I have the committee substitute.
Right.
House Bill number 109 Judiciary. It says an act relating to persons 16 or 17 years of age who are charged with unclassified or Class A felonies and amending the children's proceeding waiver provision.
That's the title I read to you. That's the one that was on the draft that the committee considered. Evidently, they changed the title before it went to the floor.
Mr. Chairman, we're having a copy brought over of the title as it appears today on the floor of the House, so we'll be able to resolve it.
The original title of the bill was an act relating to criminal prosecution of minors, but apparently the Judiciary Committee substitute was adopted with the title change. And the title change, if I'm not mistaken, and of course just at first blush, if I was looking at this, I would look to see if there wasn't a violation of civil subject rule. You get people charged with unclassified or Class A felonies and amending the children's proceedings waiver provision.
In order to get them into adult court, you have to amend the children's waiver proceedings. It all deals with the same subject, but some of it's in Title 12 and some of it's in Title 47.
So these are related then?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Looking at it in first chance there, it says amending the children's proceedings waiver provision. Whereas it looked like in this particular instance that it might have been too tight a title.
Yeah, and that may be.
I mean, the title deals with two different things, wouldn't it?
In other words, it should have been more general and shorter to begin with.
That's why I say there could be a conflict.
I hate to mention this too, but there is another provision in there that deals with the hearings of minors, the one that deals with that we're going to try to amend, that deals with whether or not victims of minors' crime, robbery, destruction can be notified of the identity of minors.
With the indulgence of the committee, I'm going to go ahead and proceed on our committee substitute. Because of the possibility of a problem, and if the problem doesn't arise, at least we can, it doesn't preclude us from working on everybody changing. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. I don't want to repeat what I've already stated in previous hearings. Basically, what this bill does is automatically waive persons who are charged with unclassified felonies if they're 16 or 17 years of age. Briefly, unclassified felonies are murder in the first, murder in the second, sexual assault in the first degree,
kidnapping,
thank you, and
first degree misconduct of violent controlled substance.
That's right. You must have a list of everything. That's what I should have in front of me. So those persons charged with those offenses would be automatically waived. If a person was waived automatically and was found guilty at trial of a lesser included offense, which was not an unclassified offense, he or she could at that time petition the court to be handled in juvenile court rather than adult court for sentencing purposes, and then the court would hold a hearing and decide after the hearing whether to send to juvenile court or adult court. If they're convicted of the offense for which they were waived, they stay right where they're at in adult court.
It also provides it on a second offense.
Well, on the first offense, they're not subject to presumptive sentencing.
Right.
On the second offense, they're subject to presumptive sentencing as a second offender.
Mm-hmm.
We give them a break for the first time around. They're not, as I stated, they're not subject to presumptive sentencing. They can get the presumptive sentence if the court believes it's appropriate. They will be held in juvenile facilities until they're waived. Once they're waived, they move to adult facilities. And the other really significant change, some of it is just language changes to make it consistent, but the other really significant change is on the last three pages of the bill where we talk about waiver of jurisdiction. This bill retains the court's ability to discretionarily waive juveniles. In addition to the automatic waiver for the unclassifieds, the court has the power to, in its discretion, waive a juvenile who is charged with any felony. So theoretically, a youngster charged with burglary or assault in the first degree and a felony could be transferred to adult court, but only after hearing and only after the court considers those nine factors which are listed on 8 and 9. The court has to decide how much weight to give each of those factors, and then it makes written findings stating whether the child should stay in the children's court or should go to adult court. It is our intent in changing the language of this to make it easier to waive certain juvenile charges of serious felony offenses. Ultimately, it will depend on the court's interpretation of the language, but based upon my research in other jurisdictions which have a similar standard, it is my belief that this standard would make it easier in appropriate circumstances for the prosecution. prosecution to be successful in obtaining Dupro waivers. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What's the definition of the term substantial likelihood?
There is no
50% plus one or 30% or substantial likelihood is a new phrase to me.
Yeah, it is a new phrase. There's no explanation of it beyond the fact that the factors that are listed are the ones that the court considers in making that determination. If there is a substantial likelihood the person can be successfully rehabilitated, then he would stay in the juvenile system. If there is no substantial likelihood, then he would
just wondering, don't we have some other language that we might be able to use there which would have case law or precedent which the courts could use?
Substantial likelihood is so nebulous that he's trying to define it, and we are too. We know what it's meant, but I mean, legally, what would it mean?
I feel like a reasonable man.
Well, it's pretty.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this standard is used in several other states, and I have other state statutes here if you'd like to look at them. The whole point of moving away from the standard which Alaska is using, which is the only standard we have Alaskan case law on, is that, in my opinion, that standard has not been working well and hasn't been interpreted correctly, in my opinion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, I agree with you. I'd like to see a change, too. It's just that a court looking at this, judge and look at substantial likelihood to try to figure out what do we mean by substantial likelihood. What's substantial and what's insubstantial? Like one judge can say, look, if there's a 1 out of 10 chance.
Why don't we put that there is no evidence that the person could be successfully rehabilitated? But there's little evidence.
Because it would make it awful hard to get these people away. You can always get evidence that they're being with treatment. There's always defense psychiatrists you can hire that will say that. So always. If the standard were no evidence, or little evidence.
I wouldn't worry about that because you got the judge. If he's going to waive it, he's going to waive it. If he isn't going to waive it, he'll find some way or some. He'll listen to one of the arguments not to waive it. He's the guy who's going to waive it.
Yeah, but he's not doing it now. See, that's our problem. We can't get kids waived now. The judges won't do it.
I don't think you're going to.
We have a tougher standard.
But with the language of substantial likelihood, that isn't going to change my mind if I'm a judge. I don't think it's going to change any judge's mind. If they're a hanging judge will get them waived. If they aren't, they wouldn't move them with car with a blast of dynamite.
To a certain extent, that's true.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
as I understand it right now, in order to waive, the prosecution has to prove that they will not be amenable to treatment, and the burden of proof is on the prosecution.
Sure.
Is that correct?
That's true for me.
But they have what's the standard of evidence that's used in proof making that proof?
Preponderance of the evidence.
Preponderance?
And that's the same standard. The burden of proof and the moving party is the same. What we've changed is the legal standard. And this is an attempt to tighten it based on my research.
What's the present legal standard?
Whether or not he's amenable to treatment under the juvenile system.
And here we're saying there's got to be substantial likelihood that he's amenable to treatment.
Not just amenable.
Your key words, if the court finds. Those are your key words. And I don't care what else you put in there, if the court finds. So it's however the inclination and the temperament of the judge.
That's right, Sam.
So, I mean, you can write almost anything, and I understand what you're trying to do here. And my only thought is to put it in some way so that the judge will, if he flies in the face of the evidence that it acts contrary to, at least the libate on his face.
I don't think I can define it any tighter. I can try. I think the factors that are listed give the judge some idea of what the legislature means when they say no substantial likelihood. If you look at the nature of the offense, the length of time left for treatment, the age of the child, whether or not anybody's ever tried to work with him before. Successfully rehabilitated, in my opinion, means he won't commit crimes anymore. So unless there's a substantial likelihood that the person won't commit crimes anymore, if he remains in the juvenile system, I would think the court would be obligated to waive.
You're giving them an open door to it.
Well, the court considers whether it constitutes a substantial danger, like murder or something. But there might be property crimes or drug offenses where the court has to look and see if, in fact, there was substantial danger. For most of these crimes, you're automatically going to have a danger because it's a serious enough crime that, you know, it's built right into the
elements. What you're doing with 16 and 17.
Yes, sir, but the majority of our juvenile murderers are 15 and 16.
Yeah, I know, but what I'm getting at is there's a far greater likelihood that they could be rehabilitated at that age than if they were 45.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what I'm trying to do is help you, but I don't know how to do it. I think you're just leaving yourself, you trapdoored yourself on number two.
Slide 19.
Yeah. I think that's where you got you. I think that's where you trapdoored yourself.
Are you talking line 19, sir? Or
yes.
Okay. I was looking at line 24.
Line 19 and 20.
Well, unless you want to make it automatic for everybody, there's got to be a standard that the judge uses for discretionary waiver. If you want to make it an automatic waiver, that certainly would make it simpler for the prosecutor because you wouldn't have to have a hearing. But that's strictly a policy.
I don't have any unbounded affection for either the prosecutor, the defense, or the judge.
Well, in the interest of protecting the public,
yes, that's my interest.
Couldn't you have language in there that says something to the effect that this isn't the language I'm suggesting, but has the effect of saying there it is more likely than not that the person you might be subject to will not be rehabilitated.
How about there is would it be too tough if you said something like there's probable cause that they to show that the person cannot be rehabilitated?
Well, see, Senator, I don't want to have to prove that he cannot be rehabilitated because it's almost impossible to prove a negative. I thought I said probable cause to believe that he cannot be rehabilitated. How do you prove that somebody can't be rehabilitated? That's proving a negative.
If he's been into children's assistance, if he's been into the counseling, if he's been in all these two or three social programs, and he still comes out a lunk, should be. I mean that to me is something along those lines. In other words, if you can show by what I don't want some kid that's maybe in the heat of something to just to be automatically waived. But somebody that's gone through all the pity pat and all the putting laying on of hands of all the high-priced social workers and all the rest of it, and say, well, really, it all stems from when he was a kid 3 years old when he had an affair with his body chair, you know. After he's gone through three or four of these things and it still shows no amenity toward being rehabilitated or even changing his ways, that to me would be sufficient to say, hey, the guy is not responding.
Right. Yeah, I understand. I agree.
I don't know what the words you would use, but I mean, that's the idea.
The problem with substantial likelihood to me is that a judge can say, look, I think there's a good chance, which means one out of 10 or one out of 5, that the kid is not going to go out and kill somebody again or whatever he's doing. But what Senator Ray and I are trying to do is, I think we're trying to do, is make it just damn difficult for the judge fly in the face of the intent of the legislature, which is, I agree with what Senator the Chairman was saying. And if you have something that says substantial, what is a substantial likelihood? It may be a chance that, one out of five. If you say something to the effect that it's more likely than not, in other words, if there's a better than 50-50 chance that the kid is gonna get in trouble again, then you wait.
I do see what you're saying.
Because no judge, if I was a judge and it says substantial likelihood, I'm not going to take that on myself and say, well, the kid was a bummer. And I knew it to start with. But if you can show a probable cause why he should be waived, or why he shouldn't be rehabilitated, or why he can't be rehabilitated, because he's gone through the process. Not only once, but three times now. He's gone through this whole process. And it hasn't done a thing for him, so something else should be tried. You know what I'm getting at?
Senator, if I may, if you have those facts that you just described, where there have been three or four unsuccessful treatments, I think under current law, I could pretty much likely get that person away depending on what he was charged with. Our problem under current law, and we run into it repeatedly, is that often the juveniles who commit the most serious offenses, i.e. murder, rape, kidnapping, have never before, or very seldom before, been in trouble with the authorities. Often it's a crime of impulse and passion, shoot both your parents in the head, for example. And since that person has never come to the attention of the juvenile authorities before, he may have been having trouble for years, but maybe no, you know, he just never got caught or nobody ever reported it. Since he's never come to the attention of the authorities, that's the situation where I can't prove that he's not treatable.
Yeah, but you don't have to. It's murder. He's automatically waived.
Under this new bill, not under the current law.
Well, the precepts, I guess you'd say, under the new law, takes care of all those heavyweights. Not even on first offense. Murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, those. Okay, so lesser offenses, I'm willing to give the guy one shot.
On a robbery? Lesser offenses or robbery?
Why not?
It's serious enough that an adult gets 6 years for it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that he might be a little concerned if he's got a 16-year-old running around doing armed robberies. I would.
First time out. He's much more easily confused in his mind at 16 years old. And he's been watching that slick guy on TV that does it all the time, you know.
Well, under this version, it would be a discretionary waiver.
That's fine. The first time.
That's right. The first time it would be.
So the second time out, you show probable cause why he hasn't been rehabilitated. As you said, he tried it the first time he was in here, Judge. He was here once before, remember? And the judge says, yeah, let's see. Now, that was hard head versus soft head.
Well, if I understand what you're saying, Senator, it seems like maybe if I can make a suggestion, play around with this language a little bit and see if maybe we can keep that standard, which I really think is a good standard, but then add additional language.
Don't try so hard to have your own way.
No, sir,
Be compromising and then take a half a loaf when you got one before you end up with nothing.
What I'm suggesting, sir, is that I define that term to include language along the lines that the senator has suggested and that you have suggested, so that the judge knows what the legislature means by that term when they use it. And I don't.
I'm getting entranced with the probable cause, and if I keep on thinking about it, I might even write one up for myself. But I would rather defer to you if you do it.
I'd be glad to do it. Is there any other area in the bill that maybe needs to be worked on?
Senator Ziegler has a problem with it.
I really don't have one, Gail. Judge Schultz does, so. Let's try this precise. John, do you want to take over? You're familiar with the proposed amendments. Tell Gail what we're thinking about and why.
Yeah, basically what we're trying to do is make it possible for the judge to discretionarily reveal the identity of a minor offender to the victim. That's already built in. The statute, there's already statutory authority, and I think it's one of the court rules are already there. So all we have to do that is take away contradictory language in these new sections that we have here that we're enacting, so that doesn't contradict the discretion of the judge.
It would be on lines 9 and 10, but not your honor, page 8. Just delete that sentence. The court may not disclose the identity of the minor. And then Mr. Gabriel had another proposed amendment to tie in that deletion.
There are just two sections that would have to be changed. That first one that you mentioned, Senator, and then the second one on page 9, line 29, just by deleting the word prohibiting and then inserting the phrase requiring a court order to authorize at that point. That would take care of all the language in there that would otherwise contradict the discretion that the judge already has.
Well, Judge Schultz felt that under certain circumstances, strictly the identity of the culprit should be revealed to the victim. Well, this is a seeking restitution,
right?
And that's all these proposed amendments would do. They would enable that situation to come about.
Well, I thought we had that upon request of the victim, when the victim's parent or guardian, of course, would disclose the victim to the minor.
language over on page 8 is contradictory, isn't it?
I don't know, I'm reading page 8.
The language now allows you to tell the victim what happened, the manner, but it doesn't allow you to know the identity.
Who did the deed, yes.
But, oh, just the manner, okay. Name, fine. I understand what you're saying.
Okay. Just to clarify, we're deleting the last sentence.
Yes.
Since it begins on line 9.
Yes, sir.
And then we're inserting that other one, the other language
on page 9. Page 9, or okay. Last line of page 9. Delete the word prohibit and insert, requiring a court order to authorize.
I believe Judge Carlson and Anchorage had the same concern.
Gail?
Yes, sir.
Getting back to successfully rehabilitated page 8, line 19 and 20, and then 21 and 22, and then there's another one over here on page 9, line 16. All I'm doing is just calling attention to that, to the places that have to be. Is there any objection to sending the victims a note?
No.
I haven't. Adopted.
I have another question, Mr. Chairman. Looking at page 1, line 11, the way I would very possibly interpret that language would include the person who was 13 years old when a crime was committed and was charged 3 years later.
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
yes.
Senator Pentagon, lines 21 and 22 of that same page.
Okay.
That is a good point, and that's why we put that in there.
This section, there are other parts of the bill where ages are also mentioned. For instance, on page 4,
page 2 also, there's a substantial likelihood. Page 2, lines 10 and 11.
I'll have to go through the whole thing.
And 12 and 13 on the same page.
Shoot. Mr. Chairman, how about if I try to work up some substitute language and maybe present it to Mr. Gabrielli on Monday?
Right. Is anybody here that would like to give any testimony on this?
Thank you, sir.
With the agreement of the committee, I will again put this on the agenda for Monday. Next, we have Senate Bill 167. This is an act related to correction facilities, good time computation in the prison and rehabilitation of funds. You got no machine today?
No machine.
This girl is in Alaska. Would you give us your name, sir, and your affiliation, and then whatever testimony you think would be there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Baden, and I'm with the Department of Public Safety. Basically, I came down today to advise that on April 7th, the Department of Public Safety wrote a letter to you, Mr. Chairman, expressing some concerns regarding SB 167. Since that date, we've spoke with the Department of Law, and those concerns that we expressed in regard to being required to maintain two contract facilities, one by corrections and one by the Department of Public Safety, have been alleviated through interpretation of the wording in this bill. And our second concern was in regard to medical expenses which might be incurred, and the Department of Law is going to suggest an amendment which would probably be more applicable than one recommended by us. So we would like to withdraw our letter of recommendation.
Letter of recommendation? Or the letter making recommendation?
Letter making the recommendation, yes.
you have any, is there any other concerns of your knowledge that the department might have?
No, sir, there are not.
Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much.
Do you have anything to say, Chris?
At this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Colonel.
Thank you.
I think the last communication we have here is from the Department of Law, the Criminal Division, and I'm sorry, this is the first time I've seen this. It's suggesting staff. Would you like to come over here and explain this, what it is?
It's basically that the, are you talking about the April 7th letter?
April 15th.
Yeah, that basically just gives you a real quick summary. You wanted a real capsule summary of what the bill does, and Mr. Stark just sort of laid it out. Quickly, he'd already done it. There's a position paper by DNSS there. It sort of does it long, capsulized. But I gave you a memo today that just lists all the things that it does. Very simple.
Mike Stark. Identify yourself, sir, and just
want to testify. Sir, my name is Michael Stark. I'm also part of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm counsel for the Division of Corrections. What I'd like to do, if I may initially, is to address the concern that Colonel Vaden spoke about, which is on the exact page of the bill. Line page 5, the line 17 through 21. If I may pass out a proposed amendment to add on to that subsection. Just so you have it before you, it'd be easier to understand.
You aren't the one that wrote up the policy of the state for treatment of prisoners, are you? The one that they have gone through all of the problem now, and certain things are being done that the state entered into an agreement.
Referring to the Cleary versus Byrne lawsuit?
Yes.
I'm counsel for the state in that lawsuit.
I do respect you, sir. That lessens my affection for you.
The senator is all interested in anything that was involved in that lawsuit. I'm more than willing to spend time with him and explain. I think that what I found repeatedly over the last several months is that members of the legislature, as well as the public, are sometimes misunderstand what's intended by some of the language in that settlement agreement court order. But the senator is all interested in everyone to explain.
I think a lot of people are misunderstanding what the constitutional interpretation of reformation is. Reformation is like beauty, I think, as somebody else said. It's in the eye of the beholder. I found, at least in the agreement that was reached, I found that, in my estimation, you went far, much further than I would.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to that issue in the Cleary lawsuit, that is left for litigation at this time. The only agreement as to reformation or rehabilitative programs, the only provisions relating to that were an agreement to provide certain programs if other agencies would be willing to provide it at no cost to corrections, no commitment to provide those programs in there, simply if there are other agencies willing to come in to the facilities. At any rate, in subsection C, line 17 through 21, which is section 3330.071 of this bill, this provides that basically what present practice is right now, when somebody's arrested for a crime and is either unconscious or in immediate need of medical attention, it's the law enforcement agency which is responsible for seeing that medical service that provided to that person prior to bringing them to a correctional facility. The concern that Colonel Vaden expressed to me, and I think is a legitimate one, is he gave an example of somebody who might be injured in an automobile accident and is subsequently arrested for drunk driving or manslaughter or something of that sort. And the injuries incurred in the accident were certainly not the result of anything done by the law enforcement agency, yet they now have custody of the individual, and under present practice and under this statute, this part of the bill, they'd be required.
I think it's self-explanatory, sir, at least my colleagues are much more legally inclined than I am, and I can understand it.
Colonel Vaden's concern was that they'd be allowed to go have the person pay for the medical care or go after his insurance company to pay for it, and this amendment, I think, would take care of that.
It's very true. We probably are much more legally inclined to
Would you like to be more physically declined? I have no objection to that amendment. In fact, I think it is a good amendment. Senator Pettenjohn?
Well, I agree.
Well, that amendment has been adopted. So I have a question, Mr. Stark. In Article 1, is that necessary in this bill? Didn't we pass comparable or similar language in Senate Bill 103? With setting up the commissioner of corrections? Didn't we do it? Do you remember that? Do you remember 103?
Yeah.
Didn't we do a substantially the same thing?
Are you referring to House Bill 103, which your committee
Yes.
That did nothing with the present statutes. It didn't simply substituted Commissioner of Corrections for Health and Social Services. It did nothing to update the language.
Well, what I mean is I don't want to be redundant, is what I'm talking about.
No, if this bill passes, the reviser would have to go through and make some housekeeping changes in terms of plugging in Commissioner of Corrections. This bill does not do that. This assumes that it's still based on the division and the Commissioner of Health and Social Services being responsible.
I'd like to know something about the good time program.
Yeah, that is the next thing I was going to mention. As you may recall, and as Senator Pettenjohn may recall, I wrote a letter on March 16th to him. Right now, page 12 of the bill deals with the sections on good time, starting on line 22. And present law provides that all prisoners who comply with the rules of the institution and are not convicted of a disciplinary infraction are given 1 day of good time credit for each 3 days they serve. That amounts to 25% of their sentence. And the practical effect of that is that after serving 75% of their sentence, if they're not paroled earlier, they would then be released on what's known as mandatory release supervision. It's a form of parole supervision. This bill provides that prisoners who are out on furlough, in a furlough program, which is typically in a halfway house, that their good time during the time they're on the furlough program would be increased to 1 day for each 2 days that they serve.
What is the criteria for this? Is this something you just arbitrarily thought up?
In terms of 1 for 2 or 1 for 3, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
1 for 3 is the existing law. 1 for 2 would increase it the next increment possible. And I suppose you could increase it a half a day rather than a whole day.
You're not answering my question. Where did this come from? Did you just arbitrarily pick this up on your own?
The Division of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services had requested last fall that this bill be drafted and actually provide for an increase in good time for 1 for 2 for all prisoners. When the Department of Law was drafting the bill last fall, we felt that there are other provisions of the bill were important enough not to endanger it by providing for that at that time. Subsequent to that time, as I'm sure you're all aware, the prison overcrowding has grown even much more serious than it was even last fall. There's a net gain each month of approximately 25 or more coming into the system. In fact, we have prisoners sitting on the floor in 3 of the institutions right now.
Mm-hmm. There's some of us that don't believe that we kick some prisoners out to make room for others.
I understand that.
Some of us believe philosophically you put them all someplace.
There's no question that we're going to have to do that unless the court orders otherwise. What I suggested in my letter to Senator Pettenjohn, since I understood that he was, as a subcommittee assignment, was responsible for this bill, was that the committee consider a committee substitute, which would in fact provide an increase of good time for 1 day for each 2 days served rather than 1 for 3. I've done quite a bit of research into what's going on in other jurisdictions, and I know that's certainly not most important in your mind, but it's certainly relevant to a consideration of that proposed amendment. Many states now already provide for that. Some states even, in fact, provide for a 1 for 1 or 50% off the sentence. The practical effect that I'm suggesting is, I would argue, insignificant for an individual prisoner. What it would be doing would, instead of getting 25% of his sentence off for good time, it would increase it to 33%, which is 8% of the sentence. It doesn't shorten the sentence. It simply provides that 8% more would be under parole supervision. The effect, though, of doing that for all prisoners rather than just for those on furlough would free up, in essence, 8% more of the prison bed. So if we have 1,000 beds in the state, that's the same as building an 80-bed institution.
I know, but I don't equate the justice and protection of the people on freeing up beds because we didn't build any jails. I mean, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just speaking my mind. And these formulas of letting people out of jail because we don't build jails, I don't comprehend that at all.
Well, again,
what's the purpose of good time?
Two purposes, really. Foster rehabilitation and encourage good conduct in the institution.
And
you do that by mitigating the severity of punishment for prisoners who demonstrate good conduct in the institution by providing for supervision time at the end of the sentence outside of the institution.
I'd like to ask you a question, and it's one that's been bugging me for a long time. We keep talking about reformation and rehabilitation and getting a person back in the mainstream of life. And yet, if he has served time as a felon, he loses his civil rights, right?
Until it's unconditional discharge, some of his civil rights.
Yeah, but is there any way possible you could have an automatic, is it a constitution that denies him his rights, or is it a statute? I don't know. I'm just making a question, because it would seem to me that that would be an incentive for fellows if he went through all his good time and everything, and he was a model prisoner, and he got his civil rights back at the end, or if he knew he was going to, he might feel a lot different about being good, because what does he got to look forward to when he gets out? And there's so many denials of certain positions in the state. You can't have to, you must be a citizen and all this jazz.
One thing this bill does address on page 11 of the bill, it resolves some of the questions you just raised, starting on page line 17, section 3330181. Right now, prison law provides that a prisoner, while he's incarcerated, civil rights are suspended. It doesn't indicate which civil rights. Our Supreme Court
is...
Line 17, page 11.
Page 11.
Yeah. Our Supreme Court has already indicated that suspension of civil rights doesn't mean suspension of all civil rights. It depends on whether the right's a fundamental right and how you restrict it. They've already ruled on that in terms of prisoners being able to go into court and sue somebody, that civil right is not affected by being incarcerated. What this section here would do would be to clarify that the only civil rights that really are affected would be the ability to serve as a juror and the ability to vote. And the subsection dealing with the ability to vote would be consistent with Title 15, which, as I'm sure the chairman remembers, just a few years ago there was a total revision of the election code. And this would bring that into compliance with that part of the statutes. It would also indicate that a prisoner would not be eligible to serve on a jury until it is unconditionally discharged. The other kinds of civil rights that come to mind are, for instance, the right to marry, that kind of thing. And courts, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that's a fundamental right. You cannot prohibit it blankly. You can limit it or restrict it. And in fact, we're right now in the Division of Corrections working on a policy which will do that in some comprehensive fashion. There are several sections of this bill which clear up problems that have existed in the present statutes, because those statutes have been around since statehood, and obviously the state of the law is not the same now as it was 25 years ago. The chairman will notice just above that section on page 11, starting at line 8, we provided for a statutory authority to monitor telephone calls of prisoners. In practice, if this bill passes, that would probably be restricted to sentenced offenders, because pretrial detainees have certain rights since they've not yet been convicted. But again, this would assure some of the concerns that this committee probably has, and certainly members of the public have, with respect to use of telephones by prisoners in the institutions. This would help to assure security in the institution and protection of the public. I think that the good time suggestions...
Do you define moral turpitude for me?
It's defined in Title 15. Unfortunately, it's not a very good definition, but basically I think what it says in Title 15 is crimes that are immoral in and of themselves. There are certain kinds of crimes that that were not wrong or illegal under common law, but which legislatures, by the authority vested in them, can make illegal. Certain white-collar crimes, for instance. The crimes, such crimes of violence, theft, dishonesty, those are immoral in and of themselves. And those are considered crimes of moral character. It actually is the large majority of our criminal statutes. Yes. Crimes of dishonesty, stealing. Again, that definition wasn't one that I argued for back then.
No, I know, but I mean, since I've been in the legislature, you can ask every attorney there, you could ask these two, probably, and they'd each give you a different answer about moral turpitude.
We'd both be right.
I think that's the same answer, but under Title 15, at least.
Moral turpitude is the eye of the beholder, is what they say.
Well, there certainly are some societies in this world where thievery is not considered to be immoral. At least in this country, I believe it always has.
What's an unconditional discharge?
that's when somebody's not only released from jail, but is no longer under any kind of supervision, whether it be probation or parole.
Then they only take parole.
Mm-hmm. You're old.
But then you still have the loss of certain rights.
The loss of rights ends at that point. When you're in conditional discharge, any rights that you had that were lost as a result of conviction are restored at that point automatically.
Right to bear arms?
No. Again, based on the offense we have for a felon carrying a concealed weapon, for a certain number of years, that is restricted.
Well, but he can carry it then over his shoulder.
Under state law, yes, it would only prohibit being carrying a concealed weapon.
Federal law.
Federal law prohibits anything to do with anything else. You don't mind me learning something on my own? I'm going to take the bar and take it.
Probably do better than a lot of us.
I would suggest by presenting a bill for all approved.
If I could again just refer briefly to the good time proposal.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
That letter was sent to me. I did not prepare a committee substitute because I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in the bill or a committee substitute?
Committee substitute. Increasing the amount of good time from 1 for 2 and 1 for 3 is sufficient to satisfy the rationale behind good time in the first place.
Yeah, I can't see why we should change the formula predicated on allowing people to get out while we're putting new people in.
Let me suggest a couple other facts to you that you may not be aware of. First of all, the present good time formula went into effect January 1, 1980. Prisoners who were in our system prior to that time, who were under the prior formula, which was somewhat higher depending on the length of sentence. The longer sentences got more good time. Those prisoners who were convicted of serious offenses and long sentences are still being given good time at the old rate, which was the equivalent of 1 for 2. Just want you to be aware that there are prisoners who are getting that benefit. I was aware that there might be some resistance to this suggestion, and I would suggest that a perhaps possible compromise to you to think about, and that would be if your concern is at least in the area of the more serious prisoners not having the benefit of more good time, that we could come up with a committee substitute which would provide for prisoners who are convicted of unclassified or unclassified and A felonies continuing 1 for 3 and others getting 1 for 2.
There's something wrong with the whole system when you go out there and there are, I forget the percentage, but it's quite large in comparison to the prison population. Of prisoners who refuse parole or probation because of the constraints contained there. They said they'd rather spend it out in jail than they would to get paroled.
They still release whether or not they want to be under those conditions, and they're required to abide by them, even if they refuse to sign the agreement. When their sentence less good time has been served, they are released under mandatory parole supervision. I'm sure Senator Petty John could
vouch for that. How about probation?
Probation is a matter for the court. If they don't comply with the conditions of probation, the court can put them back in jail.
But when the parole board, when people come up and ask to be considered for parole, they go to the parole board, right?
Right, that's discretionary parole.
Yeah, and then when people have come up now, when people have come up and are qualified to ask for parole, they won't do it.
Some do not do it because they don't want to have to attempt to comply with the conditions that the parole board sets.
So then there must be something wrong.
Well, perhaps they feel they can't abide by those conditions. Some don't apply because of the guidelines that the parole board is following. They feel they wouldn't fit within the guidelines, even though they're statutorily eligible for a parole release.
So maybe the conditions are laid down by the parole board. They're so stringent that they just rather hang it out in jail than anything else.
That's
right. I think
some of the conditions imposed by the parole board might be mandatory urine analysis twice a week. When they go outside, they won't be able to take drugs.
I don't think it's a reflection on
drinking.
Parole board requirements.
The parole board may say you cannot drink, you're not going to a bar.
So
and
I would rather stay
in
jail than to go get a little bottle twice a week?
Yeah.
Well, the temptation isn't there, at least when they're in jail, I think.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, it doesn't compute to me. You've ever been out in one of the places and hear the bars clang behind it. Doesn't do too much for them.
Again, the major consideration from the administration's point of view is the extreme emergency prison overcrowding that we have right now.
Would you consider a good time for those people on the first offenses and the second offense? No.
I mean, having an existing rate for those who have subsequent offenses and increasing it for just those on first offense.
Right.
I think that's probably...
Would that be a good compromise?
First felony, you get one for two. You got a prior felony on the sentence you served.
Maybe go hard time.
Well...
It's probably consistent with the rationale behind good time.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know, that's... It just comes to my mind.
I think, you know, the point of view that we have is that anything that is consistent with the rationale behind good time and that would help deal with the prison overcrowding is something we would support.
Would you go away and look at that and come back?
Certainly. I can't think of any problem with it, but I believe it.
That's an idea that might be worth looking into. There's a couple others I might like to take a look at.
Go ahead.
As long as you look at them.
Yes.
Furloughs. 187-33-30-101. Essentially, this grants to the commissioner the complete authority to essentially usurp the function of the parole board.
I guess I don't understand where you see that.
Well, right now you're eligible for parole after you do a 30-year time.
Right.
Under this section, you're eligible for a furlough after you do a 30-year time, unless you've been over 5 years.
Under present statute, you're eligible for furlough at any time.
After 6 months. You've got to do 6 months first.
No, that's for parole.
It's rehabilitation. No. Well, in any event, we just disagree on that.
Well, I had the statute. I wasn't aware of that. It may be the case, but I hadn't noticed that.
I'm looking at rehabilitation for that.
I don't see any restriction to 6 months. So
wow.
The statute. That's right.
Is this the supplement?
Yeah, that's the brand new. There are regulations right now that corrections has adopted which restrict eligibility.
Okay, that must be
regulations. Yeah, but that's not for rehabilitation furloughs, it's only for work furloughs. They have to be within 6 months of the release for the work furlough.
Mm-hmm.
And what this...
Not within 6 months for work furlough. I'm saying that I read, I guess it was in the regulations, not the statutes, that in order to be considered, yeah, it's in the regulations, in order to be considered for a furlough, you got to do 6 months before you get a furlough. For a felony that where there was when the term of imprisonment was beyond was over a certain amount, you had to do 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I think that only relates to parole eligibility. You have to serve.
Yeah, look at the regs. But
well, I certainly don't argue.
They changed the regs in the last 2 years.
Well, I work with them daily, and I've never noticed that there is a requirement.
I don't want to get into an argument with you. I just want to make the point that I'm aware of the lax requirements to the granting furloughs at the present time. I disagree with them. Any types of things you can do is something
good.
I imagine does represent some sort of tightening up.
Particularly on the supervisory end, AJ for no license requires corrections to do certain things. Present statutes don't require them to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
AJ lists several things that corrections must do.
At least you got to know where it is, right?
At all times, and frequent contact by supervisory personnel, periodic reports by supervisory personnel.
Well, what's the supervisor of personnel if you're the teacher, but he's got the Seward Skill Center.
Rich, I got a question on this thing. Maybe just tickle my mind here. On page 8,